why it had to be done. It's beneficial to the victim and the community in the sense that there is a guarantee of a conviction. There's always a possibility when a person does not plead guilty that something else could happen that results in them not being convicted, says Deputy Missoula County Attorney Sean Donovan. The reason we pled guilty is that it's a reduced recommendation substantially from the original proposal by the county attorney's office, says Donaldson's defense attorney Milt Datsopoulos. During the investigation, Missoula police detectives monitored a phone call between the victim and Donaldson, where Donaldson admitted taking advantage of her. He apologized to the woman and attributed the act to a drinking problem and pain medication. He made a mistake. He acknowledged that mistake early on, and based on his conduct, based on his former life, we believe strongly that this young man shouldn't have a big chunk of his life taken away from him, Datsopoulos said. Datsopoulos is concerned the federal investigations into the Missoula community and the sexual assault allegations involving UM athletes could affect Donaldson's case. 4 hours later, Gwen Florio announced the plea agreement on the Missoulian website. The victim has suffered an injury that no amount of punishing the defendant is going to fix, said Donovan. Donaldson's attorney, Milt Datsopoulos, said he doesn't believe prison is the place for his client. Hopefully, the life he's led will be the most persuasive argument in favor of a less severe sentence, Datsopoulos said. He made a mistake, and he acknowledged that mistake early on, Datsopoulos said. According to charging documents in the case, Donaldson apologized to the woman the next day. This took place at a house party, and both individuals had been drinking, Datsopoulos said. Everyone there was drinking more than they should, but that's a rite of passage, he said. Donovan said he doesn't know if the victim or her family will testify at the sentencing, but if the victim chooses, she can ask the judge to impose a longer prison sentence. She is conflicted, he said of the plea agreement. Datsopoulos said a more appropriate sentence would involve his client being placed in a pre-release center run by the Department of Corrections, and he said he's concerned that publicity over the issue of sexual assault, especially the premise that UM athletes have been given special consideration, has polluted the environment surrounding sentencing. I don't think that's completely far-fetched, but we don't want that to happen, Donovan said, adding that the county attorney's office seeks an appropriate sentence. The articles upset Allison Huguette. She felt that Milt Datsopoulos had skillfully spun his comments to portray Bo Donaldson in a very sympathetic light, while Sean Donovan's statements had failed to present a strong case for a harsh sentence. Even after the media announced that Donaldson had confessed to raping Huguette and had pleaded guilty, many Missoulians continued to believe that she was lying and he was innocent. A close friend of Huguette's named Valerie, pseudonym, told Huguette that her father had come home from a poker game and started to rant about how messed up it was that Bo Donaldson was going to have to go to jail. Why? Valerie asked her father. Would you think the same thing if it was me who'd been raped by Bo? Her dad replied that the friends he was playing cards with, men who knew both Huguette and Donaldson quite well, had assured him that Allison made up a story about being raped, and it's all a lie. In a September 12th email to prosecutors Sean Donovan and Fred Van Valkenburg, Huguette requested a meeting to discuss a few things. She explained that she was a little frustrated with some of the comments Donovan had made to reporters Irina Cates and Gwen Florio, although she appreciated that he'd mentioned she didn't necessarily agree with the plea deal. Huguette wrote, she was confused by what Donovan meant when he said she was conflicted. I have remained consistent through the entire process that Donaldson needs to go to prison for a long amount of time, and that I fully intend on testifying slash making a verbal statement to that effect at the sentencing. Milt continues to try and play this off as a mistake, and make Bo look like someone teachers, coaches, and principals will stand up for. Milt also tries to pass off some of Bo's responsibility by saying, this took place at a house party and both individuals had been drinking. Everyone there was drinking more than they should, but that's a rite of passage. From the beginning, I have been trying really hard to have faith and find the positives in each court hearing, but I am struggling to feel like I am being fully supported and defended by your office. I know Milt has the right to say whatever he wants to the media, and I am not at all shocked by what he is saying. It would just be nice if your office could be a little more aggressive in responding to some of his claims, and make your own statements reminding the public of what Bo is, which is someone who admitted to raping someone he describes as a little sister. I truly do appreciate your guys' time with the case and hope that you can understand my frustrations. Fred Van Valkenburg was born in Billings, the most populous city in Montana. He was class president of his small Catholic high school and quarterback of its football team. In 1970, he moved to Missoula to attend the University of Montana School of Law, after which he stayed in town and worked for 2 years as assistant city attorney before going into private practice, working frequently as a public defender. A Democrat, he ran for the Montana Senate in 1978, won the election, and represented Missoula's district for the next 20 years, including a 3-year stint as Senate president. In 1985, while continuing to serve in the state legislature, Van Valkenburg began working as a deputy Missoula County Attorney, and he was elected county attorney in 1998. He was re-elected to the position in 2002, 2006, and most recently 2010, when he ran unopposed. The prosecutors who worked for Fred Van Valkenburg liked and respected him. He trusted the judgment of his deputy county attorneys and gave them plenty of latitude to prosecute their cases as they saw fit. Surprisingly, given the success Van Valkenburg has had in the political arena, he's a resolutely independent thinker, and he has not been afraid to take unpopular positions and make controversial decisions. During his years in the state Senate, he was a champion of women's rights and spearheaded important legislation to prevent gender-based discrimination. His self-confidence, some call it arrogance, is renowned, as is his obstinacy. He has a well-deserved reputation for fighting stubbornly for what he believes is right, public opinion be damned. On September 19, 2012, when Allison Huguette met with Van Valkenburg to discuss her dissatisfaction with the way his office was handling her case, she was accompanied by her father, Kevin Huguette, her mother, Beth Huguette, her stepmother, Margie Huguette, and Detective Guy Baker. Allison really wanted Detective Baker to be there, Margie told me. I think his presence had a big effect on the meeting. Guy made Allison feel comfortable and safe, Kevin Huguette agreed. He was always swinging for her. Joining Van Valkenburg on his side of the table were his lieutenant, prosecutor Susie Boylan, and victim advocate Tanya Campbell. Notably absent was the lead prosecutor for Allison's case, Sean Donovan. Soon after the meeting got underway, the Huguettes told Van Valkenburg that they weren't happy with the way Donovan was handling things. They said they were glad he was able to deliver a plea deal, but they were concerned that the judge might give Donaldson a lighter sentence than the plea deal recommended if Donovan didn't go to the mat for Allison at the sentencing hearing, which was scheduled to be held on October 13th. We wanted someone to argue aggressively for the stiffest possible sentence, Kevin told me, and we didn't think Sean would do that. Kevin Huguette started pushing Van Valkenburg's buttons. I asked him, "Are you guys afraid of Milt or something? Is that what's going on here?" All of a sudden, Fred's blood pressure went up. He got red in the face and he came flying back at me. I hadn't gone into the meeting consciously intending to get him going, but it worked. By the middle of the meeting, he said, "You know what? I'll take over from here. I'll handle the sentencing hearing." "Fred told me I could have anyone in the office I wanted," Allison said. But he felt he was the most qualified. Allison didn't love Fred at all, Kevin mused, but he was the biggest stick in the office. Of all the attorneys there, he was clearly the one to choose. In the end, Allison said, Fred did a good job for me, but I think that had a lot to do with the Missoulian paying so much attention to the case and the DOJ looking into things. It gave me a lot of leverage. That's why he was willing to listen to my frustrations with Sean. If there had been no media coverage, no outside investigations, I don't think Fred would have even met with me. Chapter 16. In February 2012, when University of Montana Dean of Students Charles Couture initiated a disciplinary investigation of quarterback Jordan Johnson for allegedly raping Cecilia Washburn, the case quickly became contentious because of Johnson's celebrity status and the scorched-earth tactics that his attorney employed to defend him. Upon learning that Johnson had been accused of rape, the UM Athletic Department had arranged for him to be represented by David Paoli, a local lawyer who served on the National Advisory Board for Grizzly Athletics and had attended UM on a football scholarship in the early 1980s. Playing nose guard, Paoli anchored the defensive line for the Grizz, earning accolades for his ferocious tackling. But Paoli was no dumb jock. After graduating with honors from the UM School of Law in 1986, he clerked for a federal judge, launched his own law firm in 1992, and eventually developed into a preeminent Montana attorney. In 2011, the Montana Trial Lawyers Association designated Paoli Trial Lawyer of the Year. For many years, Milt Datsopoulos, the attorney who defended Bo Donaldson, had provided expert assistance to numerous Grizz athletes who found themselves on the wrong side of the law. But Datsopoulos was 71 years old. Jordan Johnson was the most celebrated athlete in the state. Influential people affiliated with the University of Montana apparently believed that 51-year-old David Paoli, who was notoriously pugnacious, would be a better choice to defend Johnson, given the gravity of the allegation against him. As soon as he was retained by Jordan Johnson, Paoli adopted extremely aggressive tactics to defend his client, sparing no expense. In the letter from Dean Couture notifying Johnson that he was being investigated by the university, Couture had warned, "You are to have absolutely no contact of any kind, including third party, with Ms. Washburn. Also, this is a highly confidential matter, and you are prohibited from discussing your alleged misconduct with other people. Failure to comply with these directives would result in your immediate dismissal from the university." On February 15th, 3 days after Johnson received this warning, Paoli phoned UM legal counsel David Aronofsky to raise objections about the no-contact prohibition, arguing that as Johnson's attorney, he had a legal right to question witnesses. In a follow-up email to Paoli, Aronofsky agreed but urged him to exercise restraint. "You would be meeting your professional obligations to conduct an investigation for your client, and the university will allow you to do this with the caveat that contacting the alleged victim directly or through intermediaries would not be appropriate at this time because of the no-contact instructions. I would suggest you consider going a bit cautiously on your investigation until after next Tuesday's meeting, because we may all learn information there which would be useful in whatever future steps are taken." On February 17th, ignoring Aronofsky's recommendation to wait until after the opposing parties had a chance to discuss the best way to proceed, Paoli hired a private investigator, Mark Fullerton, to observe Cecilia Washburn's house, make sure she wasn't on the premises, and then interview her two housemates in order to gather evidence that could be used to cast doubt on her claim that Jordan Johnson raped her. Although hiring private investigators to do this sort of thing is common in criminal rape cases, it had seldom, if ever, been done during a UM adjudication of a student conduct code violation. When Washburn returned home and learned that Fullerton had been there grilling her housemates about what they recalled about the night of February 4th, she became quite upset. "It was frightening," she later testified, "and she felt violated." Later, Cecilia Washburn discovered that David Paoli had also sent investigator Mark Fullerton to the tiny community where she had gone to high school. The population of the entire town was 171, to gather derogatory information about her. There was no mistaking that Paoli intended to mount an extremely aggressive defense of Johnson. When Washburn realized that a private investigator was snooping into her personal life, she called Dean Couture to express her shock and revulsion. Couture phoned Fullerton and left a message ordering him to cease and desist invading Washburn's privacy. Paoli responded immediately to Couture with a phone message of his own, reminding Couture that he had a right to question witnesses and had, in fact, obtained permission from UM counsel David Aronofsky to contact Washburn's housemates. On February 24th, Dean Couture summoned Jordan Johnson to his office for their first investigatory meeting. Paoli and Aronofsky were also in attendance. According to a legal brief filed by Paoli, Couture began the meeting and was immediately abrasive and antagonistic. Although the student conduct code indicated that he was required to present the evidence against Mr. Johnson and then allow Mr. Johnson to respond, Dean of Students Couture, to intimidate, commenced the meeting by looking at Mr. Johnson and blurted, "Did you rape Ms. Washburn?" Paoli would repeat his assertion that Couture was abrasive and antagonistic and tried to intimidate Johnson throughout the adjudication process. According to Couture's associates, the dean could indeed be brusque, but attorneys and other individuals who have tangled with Paoli in court including some who were cross-examined by him on the witness stand, find Paoli's self-righteous indignation over Couture's abrasive tone to be more than a little ironic. Almost all of Paoli's antagonists, as well as many of his admirers, are in agreement that he has an uncommonly combative disposition and will go to almost any length to win a case. Overbearing is a word not infrequently used to describe him. Bully is another. As one lawyer who has sparred with Paoli put it, Dave was a nose guard for the Grizz, and he practices law the same way he played football. He tries to run over whoever is in front of him. Those familiar with both Paoli and Couture suggest that Couture had no choice but to be aggressive when interacting with Paoli if he hoped to hold his own and be an effective advocate for Cecilia Washburn. Following the strictures decreed by the U.S. Department of Education in its 2011 Dear Colleague letter, UM, like every other American college and university, was required to use the preponderance of evidence standard as its burden of proof when adjudicating sexual assault complaints, rather than the clear and convincing evidence standard that most universities were using at the time, or the beyond a reasonable doubt standard used in the criminal justice system. To expel a student, in other words, the university had to determine that just 51% of the credible evidence indicated that the accused had committed the offense. The purpose of the lower burden of proof was to make it harder for students to get away with rape, a crime the U.S. Department of Education had determined was occurring far too frequently on American campuses. 2 months before Jordan Johnson allegedly raped Cecilia Washburn, the university court had relied on the preponderance of evidence standard to find Calvin Smith guilty of rape and expel him. But the Dear Colleague letter had been issued less than 6 months before Smith raped Caitlin Kelly, and even though UM administrators used the lower burden of proof in their case against Smith, they were tardy in revising the UM Student Conduct Code to reflect the new standard. On February 24, 2012, during Dean Couture's first meeting with Jordan Johnson and David Paoli, Johnson's counsel, Paoli made this oversight the central thrust of Johnson's defense, noting that the burden of proof specified in the Student Conduct Code, as it appeared at the time, was still the old clear and convincing standard that had been in place before the Dear Colleague letter. Therefore, Paoli argued, the older, more stringent standard must be used for the adjudication of Johnson's case. Couture and Aronofsky countered that the university simply hadn't yet gotten around to updating the Student Conduct Code to reflect the new standard, an irrelevant technicality that should not be allowed to let Johnson get away with rape. And this assertion, that the quest for truth and justice should trump procedural nitpicking, became a pivotal issue in the determination of Johnson's case. Paoli emphatically disagreed, and he railed against the university's failure to follow the letter of the Student Conduct Code as published. He also railed against many other aspects of the way the university handled Johnson's disciplinary proceedings. Not surprisingly, lawyers hired to defend students in university rape cases typically despise constraints like those imposed on their profession by the University of Montana, which forbids legal counsel to speak on behalf of their clients or interrogate witnesses during the proceedings. UM's deliberate rejection of the fundamental rules of criminal law enraged Paoli, and he frequently berated Couture and other university officials for their refusal to grant Johnson basic rights guaranteed by the criminal justice system. For his part, Dean Couture reminded Paoli that the university's investigation of his client was a disciplinary proceeding, not a criminal investigation, so it was entirely proper for the university to establish its own rules. 3 months earlier, when Couture had admonished attorney Josh Van de Wettering not to speak during the university's adjudication of the Calvin Smith case, Van de Wettering had reluctantly abided. But abiding is not in Paoli's nature. It was simply impossible for him to accept that the university had a legal right to refuse to let him speak or raise objections during the proceedings. As a consequence, Paoli often disregarded the policy and indignantly demanded to be heard. Couture, in turn, responded to these outbursts by commanding Paoli to keep his mouth shut. At one point during their February 24th meeting, according to Paoli, UM counsel David Aronofsky actually ordered him to shut up. All of which prompted Paoli to protest more forcefully than ever that Couture and Aronofsky were demonstrating a lack of impartiality. Couture, however, wasn't supposed to be impartial. His job was to function not as a dispassionate judge, but rather as the university's prosecutor. When Cecilia Washburn filed her complaint with the university accusing Johnson of rape, it was Couture's responsibility as dean of students to determine if there was probable cause to pursue a university investigation, just as it was the Missoula County Attorney's responsibility to determine if probable cause existed to pursue criminal charges against Bo Donaldson in the Allison Huguette case. After Couture's initial investigation led him to decide that there was ample reason to believe that Jordan Johnson had raped Cecilia Washburn, Couture was expected to assemble a case for Johnson's expulsion from UM, just as Deputy County Attorney Sean Donovan was expected to assemble and present a case for Donaldson's criminal conviction. A second meeting between David Paoli, Jordan Johnson, Charles Couture, and David Aronofsky was held on March 9th. During this meeting, Couture told Paoli and Johnson that he was leaning towards a finding consistent with Washburn's allegation that Johnson had raped her. Aronofsky agreed to provide Paoli with copies of the investigatory file Dean Couture had assembled about the case. Upon reviewing the file, Paoli found statements from witnesses supporting Washburn that, in Paoli's opinion, clearly showed Couture's lack of impartiality and predetermination of Jordan Johnson's guilt. For example, Paoli was irked that a witness lauded DOS Couture on how extremely understanding and compassionate he was. Paoli saw further proof of egregious bias in a statement in the file from Cecilia Washburn on February 22nd, in which she noted, "I met with Charles Couture to discuss his previous meeting with Johnson and Paoli. From what I understand, Johnson pleaded not guilty to committing the crime and had a very aggressive and entitled nature with Charles. Charles also said that Paoli was very standoffish." It didn't seem to have occurred to Paoli that showing compassion and understanding to an alleged victim was entirely proper behavior by Couture, or that Washburn's description of Johnson's demeanor as very aggressive and entitled might have been accurate. On March 27th, Charles Couture sent a letter to Jordan Johnson, informing him, "I have found a preponderance of evidence to support the allegation that you raped a fellow student, Ms. Cecilia Washburn, at her apartment on February 4th, 2012. My finding is based, in part, on the following evidence. Contrary to your repeated assertion, text messages between you and the victim prove you and the victim were more than mere acquaintances. Your previous conduct in your university residence hall. During his freshman year, Johnson had been disciplined by the university for becoming drunk and disorderly at a party. Your assertion that you and the victim had jointly initiated getting together the night of the rape. A copy of your text message to the victim clearly proves you initiated the meeting. The complete and immediate cessation of your friendship with the victim following the night of the rape. Your failure to attempt to retrieve your watch that you forgot at the victim's house, despite your assertion that this watch had been a present to you from your sister. Appropriate sanction for this type of violent physical assault are: number 1, immediate expulsion from the University of Montana. Number 2, no further access to any university property or university-sponsored activity at any time. You have the opportunity to accept or deny the charge of having violated the Student Conduct Code, and or accept or not accept the sanctions. If you deny the charge and or not accept the sanctions, you have the right to an administrative conference with the Vice President of Student Affairs, or her designee, and a hearing by the University Court." Jordan Johnson responded by denying the charge and requesting an administrative conference with Teresa Branch, the Vice President of Student Affairs. That conference was held on April 20th. In addition to Branch and Johnson, Paoli, Couture, and Aronofsky were also present. At the beginning of the meeting, Paoli hand-delivered to Branch a packet of reference letters attesting to Johnson's upstanding character, accompanied by a cover letter in which Paoli reasserted that Johnson had not raped Washburn. "I respectfully request that you ask yourself why would Jordan Johnson risk his entire life and the lives of his family by committing such a violent act when he has never done anything even remotely close to this, and well knowing that the accuser's male roommate was only a matter of a few feet outside her bedroom door." During the meeting, Paoli again argued that Couture's bias, his failure to adhere to the published student conduct code, the irregularity of this process, and the unadopted burden of proof the university was imposing on Jordan Johnson were so egregious that the charge against his client should be dismissed. But Vice President Branch was not persuaded. At the conclusion of the meeting, she denied Johnson's appeal. He immediately indicated that he would appeal to the next level, the university court. A hearing before the court was scheduled for May 10th, but Paoli was determined to halt the case before the hearing convened. He arranged for Jordan Johnson's parents to have an audience with University of Montana President Royce Engstrom, and then on May 4th, he hand-delivered a confidential letter to Engstrom claiming that the university's adjudication of Johnson had been undermined and tainted by serious failures of due process and fundamental fairness. Paoli asked Engstrom to remove Dean Charles Couture and counsel David Aronofsky from the case, take control of it himself, and start the process over from scratch with a truly impartial representative. On May 8th, when David Paoli received a letter from President Engstrom denying this highly irregular request, Paoli, on behalf of Jordan Johnson, filed a motion in United States District Court for the District of Montana for a temporary restraining order to prohibit the university from holding the university court hearing. In the event that the restraining order was rejected, on May 9th, Paoli also submitted a request to the university that two members of the university court be barred from the hearing on the grounds that they were biased against his client. On May 10th, Judge Dana Christensen denied the restraining order, and the university court hearing took place later that same day. Although the court members blackballed by Paoli had been replaced by two different individuals, as Paoli had demanded, the court found Jordan Johnson guilty of raping Cecilia Washburn by a vote of 5-2. All seven members then voted unanimously to expel Johnson from the university. On June 6th, after reviewing this decision, President Engstrom found that the court's conclusion was reasonable based on the testimony and evidence available. Additionally, Engstrom wrote to Jordan Johnson, "I do not find any procedural errors that serve to deny a fair hearing. Both sides had the opportunity to present their respective cases and question all witnesses. The court was constituted correctly, it conducted its business in accordance with the Student Conduct Code, and it did so in a timely manner. I do not find merit in the procedural objections raised in Mr. Paoli's letters. Consequently, I am making the determination that you did violate the Student Conduct Code by committing sexual intercourse without consent. Furthermore, I uphold the court's conclusion that you be expelled from the University of Montana. The review by the president constitutes the final step at the university level. I consider the matter closed. I am sorry that your career at the university must come to an end." Johnson still had one last opportunity to avoid expulsion, however. He could appeal his case beyond the university by asking for an administrative review by the Montana Commissioner of Higher Education and the Board of Regents. On June 13th, Paoli requested such a review. Commissioner Clayton Christian seemingly ruled in Jordan Johnson's favor, and Johnson was not expelled. I say seemingly because the commissioner's office has refused to disclose the outcome of the review or even acknowledge that such a review occurred, contending that it is barred from doing so by the Federal Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, and Montana Statute 20-25-515, both of which address issues pertaining to the privacy of student records. In February 2014, I filed a petition in Montana District Court requesting access to public records concerning Commissioner Christian's actions, citing Article 2 of the Constitution of the State of Montana, which states that no person shall be deprived of the right to examine documents of all public bodies or agencies of state government and its subdivisions. In September 2014, District Court Judge Kathy Seeley ruled that FERPA does not preclude release of the records in the circumstances presented in this case, nor does Montana Statute 20-25-515. Judge Seeley ordered the Commissioner's Office to provide me with the records I requested, but in October 2014, Commissioner Christian filed a motion with the Montana Supreme Court appealing Seeley's decision. The court had not yet issued a decision on the appeal by the time this book was submitted for publication. When Jordan Johnson appealed to the Commissioner's Office, the university's case against him vanished into the ether. It was as if the university court proceedings never happened. Because the criminal case against him was still moving forward, Johnson wasn't allowed to train with the football team in the summer of 2012 or play for the Grizzlies that fall, but he apparently remained enrolled as a student. Public documents released in 2013 shed some light on why Johnson was not expelled. The most revealing is a 31-page letter sent to the University of Montana President Royce Engstrom by the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of Education. Dated May 9, 2013, the letter enumerated the findings of the government's year-long investigation into UM's handling of student sexual assault allegations, and two of its paragraphs summarized Jordan Johnson's appeal to Commissioner Clayton Christian. Although neither Johnson nor Washburn was mentioned by name, there was no mistaking the case under discussion. Clayton Christian, who was appointed Commissioner of Higher Education in December 2011 by the Montana Board of Regents, is neither an educator nor a lawyer. Christian has a bachelor's degree in finance and management from the University of Montana and owns a title company. He is a successful, highly respected Missoula businessman. Prior to his appointment, a doctorate was one of the prerequisites for the job, but the regents removed that requirement just before selecting him because they believed the Commissioner of Higher Education should be a business person like Christian, according to a public statement made by the regents' vice chairman. Despite the wall of secrecy erected by the commissioner's office around the Jordan Johnson case, public information released from other sources indicates that when Johnson appealed his expulsion to Commissioner Christian, David Paoli apparently persuaded Christian that the university court incorrectly used a preponderance of the evidence as the burden of proof in finding Johnson guilty of raping Washburn, instead of holding to the more exacting, clear and convincing evidence standard. Blatantly disregarding the Department of Education's Dear Colleague letter, which explicitly stated that preponderance of the evidence is the appropriate standard for investigating allegations of sexual harassment or violence, Commissioner Christian vacated the university court's finding of guilt and sent the case back to the University of Montana to be re-adjudicated, this time using clear and convincing evidence as the burden of proof. During its reappraisal of the Jordan Johnson case, the university hired an independent consultant to conduct an impartial reinvestigation of Cecilia Washburn's allegation. At the conclusion of the consultant's inquiry, the consultant determined that Johnson's testimony wasn't credible and that there was indeed clear and convincing evidence that Johnson raped Washburn. University of Montana Dean of Students Rondi Voorhees, who replaced Dean Charles Couture when he retired in July 2012, rejected the independent consultant's determination that Johnson was guilty, however. According to the government's 2013 letter to President Engstrom, Dean Voorhees found both the complainant, Cecilia Washburn, and accused student, Jordan Johnson, to be credible, and expressed a belief that this was a case of differing perceptions and interpretations of the events in question. However, other parts of the dean's analysis questioned Washburn's credibility. For example, some of Washburn's statements began with, "I think," or "I don't think," and Dean Voorhees believed that the use of the word "think" denoted a hesitant and equivocal response. The dean concluded that there was not clear and convincing evidence to find that Johnson committed sexual misconduct. The upshot was that Dean Rondi Voorhees pronounced Jordan Johnson not guilty of raping Cecilia Washburn. In the letter to Engstrom cited previously, the Departments of Justice and Education rebuked the university for using the clear and convincing evidence standard in contravention of the Dear Colleague letter's directive to use the preponderance of the evidence standard. The feds also said that Voorhees' unilateral acquittal of Jordan Johnson did not result in an equitable resolution of Cecilia Washburn's complaint, but the government's findings came too late to do Washburn any good. After Dean Charles Couture determined in March 2012 that Jordan Johnson was guilty of raping Washburn, Johnson was given four opportunities to appeal Couture's decision. When Johnson finally prevailed on his fourth try and was declared not guilty by Dean Voorhees, Voorhees had the final say in the matter. The university's adjudication process allowed Cecilia Washburn no opportunity to appeal Voorhees' ruling. Thus, instead of expelling Jordan Johnson, the University of Montana invited him to return as the Grizzlies' quarterback, and when he did, most of Missoula rejoiced. Part 4. Scales of Justice. It is morally impossible to remain neutral in this conflict. The bystander is forced to take sides. It is very tempting to take the side of the perpetrator. All the perpetrator asks is that the bystander do nothing. He appeals to the universal desire to see, hear, and speak no evil. The victim, on the contrary, asks the bystander to share the burden of pain. The victim demands action, engagement, and remembering. In order to escape accountability for his crimes, the perpetrator does everything in his power to promote forgetting. Secrecy and silence are the perpetrator's first line of defense. If secrecy fails, the perpetrator attacks the credibility of his victim. If he cannot silence her absolutely, he tries to make sure that no one listens. To this end, he marshals an impressive array of arguments, from the most blatant denial to the most sophisticated and elegant rationalization. After every atrocity, one can expect to hear the same predictable apologies. It never happened. The victim lies. The victim exaggerates. The victim brought it upon herself. And in any case, it is time to forget the past and move on. The more powerful the perpetrator, the greater is his prerogative to name and define reality, and the more completely his arguments prevail. Judith Lewis Herman, Trauma and Recovery. Chapter 17. After Beau Donaldson agreed to plead guilty to the charge that he raped Allison Huguette, a hearing to determine his sentence was scheduled for October 13, 2012. But it was postponed until December 19th, and then postponed again until January 11, 2013. This tried the patience of Huguette and her family. The additional delay wasn't necessarily a bad thing, however, because it gave Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg more time to prepare. And as the scheduled day approached, it became disconcertingly clear that he was going to need every hour he could get. Late in the afternoon on January 9th, when Van Valkenburg met with Allison and Kevin Huguette to tell them what to expect at the hearing, which was less than 2 days away, he confessed that he was just starting to focus on what he actually intended to say. When Allison asked him if Hillary McLaughlin was all set to testify, Van Valkenburg said McLaughlin had gotten cold feet and wasn't sure she could go through with it. This was especially discouraging news. McLaughlin's account of being attacked by Donaldson in 2008 was a crucial component of the prosecution's argument that he was a sexual predator who posed a genuine threat to the community and therefore needed to be incarcerated for a long time. McLaughlin had first described the attack to Detective Guy Baker in January 2012. Then she didn't hear anything more from the Missoula police or prosecutors until the beginning of December, when Baker called to ask if McLaughlin would testify at the sentencing hearing, which at the time was expected to be held on December 19th. "He told me how much it would mean to Allison if I testified," McLaughlin remembers. "But I didn't know if I wanted to step back into it, so I asked, 'Can I have a week to think about it?' Looking back, I know that was very selfish of me, but I was worried about stirring up all the anxiety I felt from Beau trying to rape me." A week later, when Detective Baker called her back, Hillary McLaughlin says, "I told him I'm sorry, but I can't do it. I just can't put myself in that situation right now." He was like, "Okay, if that's what you want, I will respect your decision." "I got off the phone and instantly start crying. I told my husband I did the wrong thing. So I call back Detective Baker probably 5 minutes later, and he doesn't answer. I leave him a voicemail asking, 'Can I have 3 more days to think about it? Please, just give me the weekend.'" After exhaustively considering the matter over the next few days, McLaughlin told Baker that she would testify. "But then the hearing got switched to January 11th, McLaughlin says, "and I had more time to think about how hard it was going to be to say everything in court in front of all those people." A few days before the hearing, McLaughlin changed her mind yet again and told Detective Baker she was simply too frightened to go through with it. The Missoula County Courthouse and its grounds occupy an entire downtown block. A handsome, stately building constructed in 1910 from quarried sandstone blocks, it's crowned by a domed clock tower visible from miles away. As Allison Huguette and her family walked from their car to the courthouse doors shortly before 9 o'clock on the morning of January 11, 2013, an overnight blizzard had abated, but the storm had left 5 inches of fresh snow on the ground, and the temperature was 17 degrees Fahrenheit. Up on the third floor, when Judge Karen Townsend said, "Please be seated, everybody," the large courtroom was overflowing with Missoulians who'd come to learn Beau Donaldson's fate. His supporters, including family members and Grizz teammates, filled the seats in the eastern half of the room. Most of Allison Huguette's supporters sat on the other side. Everyone was in uncomfortably close proximity. The air was stale, and the tension in the courtroom was palpable. Donaldson, wearing a tie and black slacks but no jacket, sat with his lawyers, Milt Datsopoulos and Peter Lasney, at the defending counsel's table. Donaldson's broad back and shoulders strained the seams of a freshly pressed shirt. Fred Van Valkenburgh and Sean Donovan sat at the prosecuting counsel's table, representing the state, which would present its witnesses before any witness for the defense were called. Van Valkenburgh asked Kevin Huguette to take the stand, and Kevin got the hearing off to a dramatic start. Unable to contain his rage, Kevin began by saying, "I'm obviously pissed off." Then he pointed at Donaldson and declared, "That kid right there is a no-good rapist piece of shit that raped my daughter, and I hope he rots in hell, frankly." Almost everyone in the packed courtroom was taken aback by the vehemence of the outburst. "I know he's got a bunch of friends and family here," Kevin continued, "but I don't really care. What you did to my daughter was wrong." Milt Datsopoulos jumped to his feet and interrupted Kevin Huguette to object. "Your Honor, this is a courtroom. Certain remarks are..." "I think I have some latitude on the plaintiff's part of this," Kevin said, cutting Datsopoulos off. "So, Mr. Huguette," Judge Townsend interjected, "I am going to ask you..." "Those are the only cuss words," Kevin promised. "All right, no more," Townsend warned. Resuming his testimony, Kevin said, "The rapist has no idea the pain and hurt he has caused our family. This rapist decided to attack and rape my daughter while she was sleeping. How long did this perverted monster look at my defenseless daughter before he decided to act out the rape of a longtime friend? After he raped her, she had to sneak out of the house, running down the street calling for help. Then she turned around and realized the rapist was chasing her." Kevin Huguette asked Judge Townsend if she, as a parent, could imagine anything more scary than having the man who just raped your daughter chasing her down a street. Furthermore, Kevin said, even after Bo Donaldson confessed to the police on tape that he raped Allison, he told his friends and family that he'd been falsely accused, and he encouraged them to slander Allison. "They've made it impossible for my daughter, who was born and raised here, to go out like a normal 23-year-old and enjoy herself. Instead, it's verbal aggression and intimidation. Does this sound like the rapist has told the truth or really taken responsibility?" Kevin pointed out that Donaldson not only lied to his friends and family about what he did to Allison, he also told both of the psychologists who performed pre-sentencing psychosexual evaluations of him that the sex they had was consensual, not an act of rape. When Allison Huguette had a chance encounter with Bo Donaldson at the Mo Club, 14 months after he assaulted her while she slept, Kevin said, "This rapist laughed in my daughter's face. Does this sound like someone who regrets what he did? He felt entitled to do anything he wanted to any woman. My daughter trusted him. She knew him since first grade. They were friends, yet he could still rape her. For some reason, some people feel sorry for this rapist. For the people testifying about what a good guy he is, you have no idea of the tears and the pain and the hurt that was caused by this rapist and the potential years of counseling and healing my daughter has in front of her. I'm so proud of my daughter for standing up and not letting him get away with this," Kevin continued. "She's amazing, smart, incredible, and beautiful on the inside and out, and didn't deserve to have this happen to her. Judge, please do the right thing and send him to Deer Lodge, where he belongs." Keeley Williams testified after Kevin Huguette. She told the court that Allison Huguette was her best friend and that she had known Bo Donaldson since kindergarten. When prosecutor Fred Van Valkenburgh asked her to describe the party at Donaldson's house in September 2010, Williams said there were about 30 people in attendance. She and Allison arrived around 10 p.m., Williams recalled, and went to bed between 2 and 3 a.m. She testified that Donaldson and Huguette did not kiss or fondle each other at all. "That would not happen. Bo had a girlfriend at the time," said Williams. "The relationship between Donaldson and Huguette had never been romantic or sexual," Williams emphasized. At the conclusion of the party, when Allison went to sleep on a couch alone, Keeley Williams recalled, "I went to wake her to have her come sleep with me, and she said, 'I'm fine, I'll just sleep here.' and so I left her on the couch. The next thing she remembers, she said, was a phone call from Allison crying, saying, "Beau raped me. You need to get out of the house right now. My mom and I are outside to get you." So I got my stuff together, and I ran outside, where Mrs. Huguette was waiting with Allison in the car. As Beth Huguette drove Allison to the hospital, Van Valkenburgh asked Williams, "What was Allison doing? How did she react during that period of time?" "She just kept crying," Williams answered. "She couldn't even talk. She just cried the whole way. The next morning I called to see how she was."
"And what was happening then?" Van Valkenburgh asked.
"She was still crying," Williams said. She then described going to the Grizz game with Allison. She tried to act like she was fine, but didn't make it hardly through the game. Van Valkenburgh asked Keeley Williams if Allison ever talked about reporting this matter to the police. "She didn't want to go to the police," Williams replied.
"Why not?"
"She told me that she didn't want to ruin his life, and she wanted to give him a chance to make it better."
Van Valkenburgh asked Williams why Allison eventually decided to report the rape to Detective Baker.
"I remember her saying that if she had just gone to the police right away," Williams answered, "that maybe the other girls that had been raped wouldn't feel like they wouldn't be believed, and that they could stand up for themselves, too."
"It's been nearly a year now since Beau was charged with raping Allison," Van Valkenburgh said. "How has this last year been on her?"
"It's been extremely difficult."
"Why is that?"
"She felt like she couldn't come home and couldn't be in Missoula because people were so horrible to her. And when she went back to school in Oregon, she couldn't focus, and she had a hard time finishing college at the end because she had so much to deal with here and couldn't be present in school."
"Do you feel like Beau has accepted responsibility for what he did to Allison?" Van Valkenburgh asked.
"No."
"Why not?"
"If Beau Donaldson had accepted responsibility," Keeley Williams replied, "he would have stopped his family and friends from saying horrible things about Allison and her family during the 15 months after he raped Allison, before she reported him to the police."
Van Valkenburgh asked Williams, "What do you think the judge should do to Beau Donaldson?"
"I think the judge should sentence Beau to the 30 years he agreed to," she replied, "so that he has time to deal with the issues that he so clearly has."
Turning to Judge Townsend, Van Valkenburgh said, "I have no other questions, Your Honor."
"Cross-examination, Mr. Detsopoulos?" Townsend asked.
Keeley Williams had been a very sympathetic witness, sincere, utterly convincing, and likable. Because this was a sentencing hearing and not a trial, there was no jury Detsopoulos could pander to. Calculating that he stood to gain nothing with Judge Townsend by challenging Williams' testimony, he replied, "We have no cross-examination." The prosecution's next witness was Hillary McLaughlin. When the hearing had been postponed until January, McLaughlin lost her nerve and said she couldn't testify. Less than 2 days before the hearing, however, Detective Baker persuaded her to change her mind. But because she had a 10-month-old baby and the roads were icy, the state had arranged for her to testify via video to avoid having to make the treacherous 200-mile drive from Great Falls to Missoula. McLaughlin, a slight woman with long blonde hair, appeared on a large video screen on the west side of the courtroom. She began by describing the party at Joanna Sutherland's house in 2008.
"I had never met Beau before," McLaughlin said, "but throughout the night he was all over me and wouldn't leave me alone."
McLaughlin explained that shortly after she went to bed, Beau walked in the door, shut and locked the door behind him, pulled down his khaki shorts and underwear, climbed onto the bed, and began to grind his naked genitals into her pelvis. Even as McLaughlin screamed for help and her friends were trying to break down the bedroom door, she recalled, "Beau continued to grind on top of me." After the attack, she said, "I told very few people and tried to block it from my mind. Ever since that night, it has affected the way I live my life. I live in constant fear of being attacked walking to and from my house, to and from work, and while in my own home. I have a very hard time trusting anybody around me. I've struggled with extreme anxiety," McLaughlin continued, "and I've recently been put on medication to help deal with it. This has changed the way I carry myself as a person."
She said she had finally decided to tell her story in public because Beau Donaldson clearly had not taken responsibility for attacking her or raping Allison Huguette, and McLaughlin hoped her statement would help prevent it from happening to someone else. No one should have to live their life in fear because of someone else. When Beth Huguette, Allison's mother, took the witness stand, prosecutor Fred Van Valkenburg began by asking her to tell the court about Allison's birth and the kind of relationship they had. Allison, Beth said, was a very large baby, and her birth had been difficult. 26 hours. They had to break both of her collarbones for her to be delivered, and yet, 4 hours after she was delivered, she was smiling. She had curls in her hair. Allison has always been happy-go-lucky, smiling. My parents have always described her as almost angelical and cherub-like, wanting the best in the world for everyone, and non-judgmental. A very loving, very caring individual who has been a spark in my life. A love in my life. Beth Huguette testified that Allison has always been very open and honest with me and has confided in me about a lot of things. I've always believed we've had maybe a stronger mother-daughter relationship than a lot of other mothers do. I think part of this is for me being a high school teacher. I'm able to have an honest rapport with the kids. And I have a pretty good BS detector, so I can figure out when my children are telling me things. Asked by Van Valkenburg to describe Beau Donaldson when he was growing up, Beth explained that the Target Range neighborhood where Beau and Allison were raised and attended school together is a tight community. That group of kids, she said, were always very close, took care of each other, looked out for each other. I know Allison always looked at Beau as the big brother that she didn't have. When Van Valkenburg asked Beth Huguette about the night Donaldson raped Allison, she told the court about being awakened in the middle of the night by a phone call from Allison pleading, "Save me, Mom, help me. He's chasing me down an alley." As Allison ran for her life, Beth told the court, she could hear a male voice in the background, commanding Allison to stop and warning her not to say anything. I thought, God, I know that voice, Beth said. After driving across town to Donaldson's neighborhood, she saw Allison running along South Avenue with one hand clutching her phone and the other hand holding up her pants. She got in the car and she just kept rocking back and forth and just crying frantically. And then she said, Beau raped me. Beth Huguette testified that Allison asked her not to share that information with anybody. You didn't share it with Allison's father? Van Valkenburg asked. I shared it with no one, Beth said. It wasn't my right. It was my child's right. She was an adult. I needed to protect her wishes. During the months that followed, Beth said her home became almost like a tomb from Allison's crying and walking in the middle of the night and sobbing. It was 5 months of complete, sheer hell, to say the least, to watch her go so far within herself. The raw pain, the internal raw pain that was there every day, and I could see it in her eyes, was horrific, to the point where I could barely function. To get up every day and go to school and teach and keep a smile on my face when I had a child that was suffering so horrifically. Allison wasn't the same person anymore, Beth continued. There was no smiles. There was no laughs. She went back to school in Oregon in January, but I would frequently get calls from her about every other day where she was having trouble focusing on school. At least she was out of Missoula and the people there didn't know, but internally she was being eaten alive. She had a lot of fear and anxiety. Beth Huguette told the court about Allison's visit to Missoula during Eastern Oregon University's Thanksgiving break in November 2011. It was an especially awkward visit, Beth said, because she and Allison were trying to keep the rape secret from her sisters and father so they wouldn't have to endure the anguish Beth and Allison were feeling. To that end, Beth explained, every day she and Allison had to put a brave face on. Then Allison went downtown with her friends one night and ran into Beau Donaldson at the Mo Club. I think that's when it hit her full force, how deep-seated her pain and fear was, Beth testified. And that she really wasn't living. She was just managing day to day, getting up and putting one foot in front of the other. Van Valkenburg asked Beth if she thought Donaldson had
done a good job of telling his family and his friends exactly what he did to Allison.
No, she replied, pointing out that even after confessing twice to the police that he raped Allison, he chose to let his family and friends believe that he didn't do it. And that's not a person standing up for what's right.
Beau has been put on a pedestal most of his life, Beth continued, suggesting that his many admirers wanted to believe he didn't do it, and he chose to allow them to believe he didn't do it.
When defense counsel Milt Detsopoulos was given the opportunity to cross-examine Beth Huguette, he tried to elicit testimony from her that Beau Donaldson had been an exemplary friend to Allison as they grew up together. At one point, Detsopoulos asked Beth if there was anything she'd observed in Donaldson over the many years she had known him to suggest he might have some kind of violent or mean streak.
He didn't do anything to me or my child, Beth conceded.
But, she said a moment later, I guess that's what makes this even more horrific, is that this is such an extreme betrayal between friends.
Detsopoulos kept pushing Beth to take Beau Donaldson's entire life into consideration rather than just a single, inexplicable act.
When you measure people's lives, who they are, Detsopoulos pointed out, you have to look at the entire spectrum of that life, not a narrow piece of it. Wouldn't you say that's an accurate premise?
Yes, Beth Huguette replied. But then she pointed out that there are sides to people that are impossible for even family members and close friends to know. I think Beau's sexual deviancy is a side that many of us were not aware of.
Chapter 18. When Beth Huguette finished her testimony, prosecutor Fred Van Valkenburg called Allison Huguette to the witness stand. As one of his first questions, he asked if she had ever had a romantic or sexual relationship with Beau Donaldson.
No, Allison replied, but Beau and I were closer than I was to any other guy growing up, and had a lot of respect for each other, I thought.
Referring to the night Huguette was raped, Van Valkenburg asked, do you know where Beau Donaldson was at the time you decided to go to sleep?
No, she said.
What's the next thing you remember happening, Allison?
I remember waking up to Beau moaning and a lot of pressure and pain, she answered.
She was face down on the couch with her pants pulled down, and Beau was penetrating her from behind.
Were you scared? Van Valkenburg asked.
Yeah, she replied. I mean, he's got at least 100 pounds on me. If he's willing to do that while I'm sleeping, I definitely thought he would have done a lot more to keep me from resisting or telling somebody. So I pretended like I didn't wake up.
Allison described waiting until Donaldson had finished raping her and left the room, then grabbing her phone, bolting from the house, and being chased barefoot down the alley by Donaldson until she saw her mother's car. She told the court about driving back to Donaldson's house to rescue her friend Keeley Williams and being examined at the hospital.
Because Donaldson hadn't used a condom, she testified, she worried that she might become pregnant with his child or have contracted multiple STDs, including HIV.
Van Valkenburg asked Huguette how she was affected by encountering Beau Donaldson at the Mo Club in November 2011.
At that moment, Huguette said, it hit me that, as hard as I tried to separate the person who raped me and the person I grew up with, I had to realize that they were the same person. And he was not sorry. He was not sorry in any way. When Beau stood there and laughed in my face, I think I was forced to realize that by not going to the police, I was allowing him to think that this was okay, and I was giving him the opportunity to do this to other females. And I can be honest with you in saying that if I had found out that some girl was going through this hell because I didn't say anything, I probably would have killed myself. There is no way I could have lived with that at all.
What's this last year been like for you? Van Valkenburg asked.
It's been hell, Huguette said.
It was very obvious that Beau had not told his family or friends the truth, as they went around this town saying horrible things about me, saying that I had made this all up.
What do you think should happen to Beau? Van Valkenburg asked.
She had been struggling to answer that question, Huguette replied, explaining that he was someone that I cared about, I truly loved, and he's the person that raped me. I believe that if I didn't know Beau, if Beau was a complete stranger,
I would ask for you to have him sent to prison for the rest of his life. But unfortunately, I can't take away the fact that I care about him. I want him to get help. I want him to be the person that I grew up with. Beau Donaldson had received many accolades when he was younger, Huguette acknowledged, and deserved the love